Welcome to We've Got Issues. I'm Joshua Holland. This week we're going to speak to John Storr. First, as always, I am joined by Liz Prezza, Alternet's managing editor. How are you, Liz?
Surviving.
Surviving. Yeah, stressful. Stressful times. Very... Yeah. Hopefully this time next week we will be in a state of relief.
Yeah.
You know, I hope so.
Yeah.
Before we get to John Storr, I wanted to just listen to a couple of audio clips this week, partially because I'm hungover and don't want to talk too much. But there was some madness on the right. I'm sure you caught the Tucker Carlson thing, right?
Yeah, the Tucker Carlson thing is beautiful.
It is beautiful. Let's listen to the Tucker Carlson thing for one moment.
My executive producer, Justin Wells, and I were in Los Angeles preparing to interview Tony Bobulinski about the Biden's business dealings in China, Ukraine, and other countries. So we texted a producer in New York, and we asked him to send those documents to us in L.A., and he did that. So Monday afternoon of this week, he shipped those documents overnight to California with a large national carrier, a brand name company that we've used, you've used countless times with never a single problem. But the Biden documents never arrived in Los Angeles. Tuesday morning, we received word from the shipping company that our package had been opened and the contents were missing. The documents had disappeared. Now, to its credit, the company took this very seriously and immediately began a search. They traced the envelope from the moment our producers dropped it off in Manhattan on Monday all the way to 3:44 a.m. yesterday morning. That's when an employee at a sorting facility in another state noticed that our package was open and empty. Apparently, it had been opened. So the company's security team interviewed every one of its employees who touched the envelope we sent. They searched the plane and the trucks that carried it. They went through the office in New York where our producer dropped that package off. They combed the entire cavernous sorting facility. They used pictures of what we had sent so that searchers would know what to look for. They went far and beyond, but they found nothing. Those documents have vanished. As of tonight, the company has no idea and no working theory even about what happened to this trove of materials, documents that are directly relevant to the presidential campaign just 6 days from now. We spoke to executives at that company a few hours ago. They seemed baffled and deeply bothered by this, and so are we.
So, his dog ate his homework. That's, I mean, what else can you say about that?
Well, we have an update from UPS as of Thursday that the documents have been found and they're on their way to Tucker Carlson. So he can get them. Oh.
So yeah, it seems the jig is up, I guess, huh?
Jig
is up.
Joe Biden is definitely screwed.
Yeah, he's toast. He's toast.
The beautiful thing about it is, like, you know, he didn't make a copy of these documents before sending them?
I mean, you know, the deep state might be monitoring the copy machines. You can't, you know. Meanwhile, Rudy Giuliani is mad, so mad that, and he's blaming a lot of the kind of discombobulated nature of the Biden controversy on Bill Barr.
Huh.
Yeah.
How's he making that leap?
Well, he wants the Department of Justice to basically give it credibility by announcing some sort of investigation. Meanwhile, nobody really knows what the charges really are. It's right. a little bit confusing, hard to figure out. As far as I can tell, it seems like Hunter Biden introduced people to his father. That's the allegation. There's certainly no, like, quid pro quo. It's hard to.
It's something about Hunter Biden, like, trading off his name as a Biden, which is so disqualifying for a president's family to do.
I mean, you know, it's like, it's just crazy. Well, every accusation is a confession, but this is especially ridiculous, just given that, you know, you could get ripped off by Trump University and then afterwards have a Trump steak and drink a Trump wine and, you know, sit on your Trump home furniture collection. And, But yeah, they're making money off the Biden name, so whatever. This is all crazy.
I mean, lucrative Biden name.
The right wing has just gone completely crazy, and their, you know, their persecution complex is off the charts. Actually, did you catch this little exchange between Ron Johnson and Jack from Twitter, Jack Dorsey?
Oh, is it about censorship? I didn't catch it.
No, he's mad about a tweet. So let's listen to this.
Let me give you a tweet that was put up on Twitter. It says, "Senator Ron Johnson is my neighbor and strangled our dog Buttons right in front of my 4-year-old son and 3-year-old daughter. The police refused to investigate. This is a complete lie, but important to retweet and note that there are more of my lies to come." Now, we contacted Twitter, and we asked him to take it down, and here's the response. "Thanks for reaching out. We escalated this to our support team for their review, and they have determined that this is not a violation of our policies." So, Mr. Dorsey, how could a complete lie, it's admitted it's a lie, how does that not affect civic integrity? How could you view that not as being election interference? Let's face it, that could definitely impact my ability to get reelected. How could that not be a violation of voter suppression? Obviously, if people think I'm strangling my neighbor's dog, they may not show up at the polls. That would be voter suppression. So why didn't Twitter take that? By the way, that tweet was retweeted like something like 17,000 times and viewed by over, and loved, commented, you know, appreciated by over 50,000 people. How is that not voter suppression? How is that not election interference? How does that not affect the civic integrity?
Well, we'll have to look into our enforcement or non-enforcement in this case of the tweet, and we can get back to you with more context.
I mean, the funny thing is, like, at the end of the at the end of that tweet, it says, "This is a lie," and I'm just, you know, I'm making this tweet to show an example of how easy it is to spread information. By the way, Liz, I have to tell you something, and this is disturbing. I have a source, a very sensitive source, and this source obtained security camera footage of Ron Johnson murdering poor Buttons, and they sent it to me via a major national carrier.
And then
it got lost.
Oh no!
Yeah, and
be the deep state.
The carrier, you know, they looked everywhere, and they're very troubled by this, and I'm also very troubled by this. I had the whole Buttons caper really locked down.
Yeah, these people have all gone mad. I mean, that's what happens when you attach yourself to a madman.
You know, attach yourself to a madman. That's a perfect segue for this other piece of audio that I wanted to play. This is Trump welcoming Senator Martha McSally to his Nuremberg rally, wherever he held it. Let's COVID-19. Listen to this. Yeah, super spreader event. Yep.
A woman who's running for the Senate, currently a senator respected by everybody. Her opponent wants to terminate your Second Amendment. Martha McSally. Martha. Great. Great. Martha, great. Martha, come up just fast. Quick. Come. Fast. Fast. Come on, quick. You got 1 minute. 1 minute, Martha's sake. They don't want to hear this, Martha. Come on, let's go. Quick, 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 quick. Come on, let's go.
All right. I'm coming. Thank you, President Trump.
How utterly humiliating.
God, I would feel bad for her if she didn't do this to herself.
If she wasn't a horrible person. This is what happens when you latch on to a misogynistic dirtbag.
Yeah. I mean, I couldn't care less about her, honestly, considering she's one of two senators who were appointed by Republican governors who then went on to vote for Barrett's confirmation. It's like, did you see that tweet by Marco Rubio saying like 52 legitimately elected senators legitimately voted to legitimately place Barrett on the Supreme Court. It's like, if you have to say legitimately three times, sir.
He also said, he also referred to the legitimately elected president, which that, you know, if you right. win a minority of the popular vote, you're not legitimate in my eyes.
We have a very screwy system that this is what's going down.
But listen, I'm all for that standard because, you know, I am hoping that we'll be in a position where a legitimately elected mm-hmm. president and Senate will expand that court and... Mm-hmm. You know, they've set that standard, you know, elections matter.
Yeah.
Elections matter. I must say, just getting back to Martha McSally briefly, if you asked me, can you say one good thing about Donald Trump? I would say that the only thing that I like about him, literally the only thing I like about him, is his tendency to publicly humiliate his like most loyal psycho fans. I like that about him because I, you know, I can't stand these people. Martha McSally, that he, remember he called Matt Gaetz Rick like seven different times. And Matt Gaetz is such a like suck up to Trump. And he just totally forgot his name.
Yeah, there's something just poetic about it.
Or Jeff Sessions, like just the way he humiliated Jeff Sessions and ruined his entire political career. I was like, okay, you know, that's the one thing I will acknowledge from Donald Trump. And finally, one last piece of audio. This was a moment, it struck me on Twitter. I said this on Twitter. This is just a moment from a debate between John Ossoff and David Perdue for one of the two Georgia Senate races. And what I found striking about this is it is the most West Wing moment I've ever seen in real life. Like Aaron Sorkin wrote this for Ossoff. Let's listen.
Well, perhaps Senator Perdue would have been able to respond properly to the COVID-19 pandemic if you hadn't been fending off multiple federal investigations for insider trading. It's not just that you're a crook, Senator. It's that you're attacking the health of the people that you represent. You did say COVID-19 was no deadlier than the flu. You did say there would be no significant uptick in cases. All the while, you were looking after your own assets and your own portfolio, and you did vote four times to end protections for pre-existing conditions. Four times. And the legislation that you tout, the PROTECT Act, it includes loopholes that specifically allow insurance companies to deny policies to Georgians with pre-existing conditions. Can you look down the camera and tell the people of this state why you voted four times to allow insurance companies to deny us health coverage because we may suffer from diabetes or heart disease or asthma or have cancer in remission? Why, Senator?
I mean, that is a just a brutal.
It's beautiful, yeah.
Brutal curb stomping. And, you know, listening to the audio, it doesn't really give you that side-by-side where you can look at
his
face. Perdue.
You should just go look at it.
You should look at it because Perdue's just sitting there. It looks like something was inserted into his rectum.
You're caught in the headlights for sure.
He's just, and at one point he just raises his finger in this pathetic little, and that's when you see his soul leave his body. It was just a brutal murder. I've never seen anything like it.
Yeah, the comeuppance we've all been waiting for.
Oh yeah, yeah. So I'm not a huge Ossoff fan,
right. But
I'm giving him major points for that exchange, and I. You know, he'd certainly make a much better senator than David Perdue.
He's a little vanilla, but
he's definitely vanilla. He's a little centrist for me. He kind of, you know, he is one to echo kind of conservative framing for various issues. But hey, look, I mean, Perdue is corrupt. He was, as he said in that clip, is like he was doing all that insider trading while denying that the pandemic was a severe threat. So.
I think the Senate fights the real headline, I think, out of this election.
I mean, you know, it would be catastrophic for Trump to win a second term, but right. almost as bad for Biden to win and have Mitch McConnell lead the Senate. That would be.
I mean, it would just be 4 years of absolutely nothing.
Nothing. And you know, it would probably not be good for the midterms. Just a complete disaster. Yeah. Although 22 is a Democrats have a good Senate map in 22. So you know, you never know what might happen. Mm-hmm. Anyway, let's take a quick break and come right back with John Stewart. Stay tuned.
Slow down and listen, what's your secret? I'm lost in a daydream, can't find meaning. For the longest night, I want it back. 'Cause I'm a sucker for you, yeah, I'm a sucker for you. Yeah.
Welcome back. I'm still Joshua Holland, and I'm joined now by John Storr. John is the editor-in-chief and writer of the editorial board. John, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me. Good to be
here. Thanks for taking the time to speak with me. So here we are. We're recording this on Wednesday afternoon, 6 days before the 2020 election. How's your stress level, my friend?
Oh, my God. I am shouldering a quiet dread.
Right? Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, one of the weird ironies of this cycle is that, you know, all of the metrics point to a significant Democratic victory. Mm-hmm. And I'm talking, you can look at the national polling, you can look at swing state polling in enough states to get to 270 electoral college votes.
Mm-hmm.
I've been looking at the congressional generic ballot, which I think is a great kind of just check in for the other information, because it doesn't name Trump or Biden. It just says, are you going to vote for a Republican or a Democrat? Democrats are up by 7.6% in that metric in 538's polling average. They were up 8.8%, 8.8 percentage points in 2018. And yet, this is so stressful because of the president's demagoguery of mail-in ballots, mm-hmm. the stacked courts, relentless voter suppression at every level. I mean, do you see this election as causing a kind of sea change in the attitudes of Democrats, not only the election, but the ramrodding through of Amy Coney Barrett in record time during an election when 40 million ballots had already been cast? Do you think that we're going to see, a consensus emerge between the left flank of the party and more centrist Democrats? I'm seeing some evidence of that already. Your thoughts?
Yeah. A big indicator for me of this revived liberal consensus or a new liberal consensus, an indicator for me is what Biden says about the court. In that 60 Minutes interview he did on Sunday, that's where he announced that he would put together a bipartisan commission to study not if or whether he should propose reforms to the court system, but how he was going to do it. And I thought that was a big tell. That to me suggests intent. Like there is going to be something with respect to the Supreme Court and its new 6-3 conservative supermajority. There's going to be some kind of reaction. For Biden is not somebody who just does something because he feels like it. You know, he does something because he thinks it's the right thing to do, first of all, and second, that he has the political support to do it. My thinking is that A, he's not going to get a single Republican to get on board this, and so therefore he's not going to bother with some kind of bipartisanness, not from elected Republicans. But as long as he does not lose any one of the members of the Democratic Party, you know, in other words, as long as he can prevent opposition to court reforms from appearing bipartisan, he'll be okay to move forward.
You know, I think that what is happening here is that, you know, we're seeing such egregious Republican overreach,
right,
that they're really not giving them any choices. And mm-hmm. getting back to this election, the stress that we're experiencing is entirely because of changes to the law. Mm-hmm. Going back to Shelby, mm-hmm. The Supreme Court decision that gutted the Voting Rights Act and got rid of significant parts of what prevented states from engaging in too blatant voter suppression. Mm-hmm. Also in 2018, a judge canceled the consent decree that the Republican Party had entered into in the 80s, mm-hmm. barring it from sending thugs to quote unquote monitor polling places. This is all kind of like the chickens coming home to roost. Mm-hmm. Now, Democrats, if the Democrats manage to win, if they win the White House and the Senate, you know, they're going to be saddled with a catastrophic series of crises to manage. They're going to need to spend a ton of money, and they're going to have to pass some sort of new Voting Rights Act to avoid the kind of bullshit we're seeing in this election, relentless bullshit, trying to get people to not be able to vote. Mm-hmm. And those, whatever they pass on that front, is going to be struck down by this court. Mm-hmm. And there's almost no way to imagine that it won't be, right, with Amy Coney Barrett as a block of six. That is to say, with Amy Coney Barrett as a replacement basically for Roberts, mm-hmm. who maintained sort of a guardrail on the court, mm-hmm. just because of his concerns about the legitimacy of the institution. Mm-hmm. So I think that Republicans are forcing Democrats' hands on this.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, going back to your point about the court pushing back against whatever legislation the Congress puts forward, that's a great fight for the Democrats to have, I think. You definitely want to. I've always thought that it's more important to have control of the Congress than it is even to have control of the presidency, because you want to be. The Congress is what is the in theory anyway is the reflection of the general consensus among voters, and you want to be in a position where you can offer up something to the people, get it passed through, get popular legislation accomplished. And if the court dares to strike it down, dare them, you know, say you are nine people and we are the rest of the country. If you are going to strike us down, go ahead and strike us down. And then we will really take action.
Yes, I agree. And one concern that I have, and I shouldn't say it's a concern, I hope that indeed the court does not strike down the Affordable Care Act because of the human cost of that. But I could very easily see some defensive rulings by a newly empowered 6-3 court,
yeah,
in order to stave off the pressure from the left to expand the court to 13 seats. I could see them, you know, upholding the Affordable Care Act. Mm-hmm. It is a goofy case, mm-hmm. and doing other things that would in an attempt to play politics. This is a politicized court, you know.
Yeah, I definitely think there's. I think it. Just imagine if you know, right after the election, right after Amy Coney Barrett is confirmed, that the court strikes down Obamacare. Talk about overreach. Overreach doesn't even capture what that would be.
Right? Yeah.
And it certainly would not capture what the reaction would be when 20 million people lose their health insurance, myself included. You know, so So because that is such an extreme thing to even imagine, it seems unlikely. And the case, as you mentioned, is really goofy. It's basically the fact that it's a silly argument about, since there is no more individual mandate, then that invalidates the entire body of law. And of course, that's nonsense. It's the kind of case brought to the Supreme Court that the justices could see them unanimously dismissing it just because it's a silly case, you know, and then have it be done with. And therefore curry favor among skeptical people like me, you know, like, oh, okay, maybe you're not as illegitimate as I thought you were.
Yeah. And yet I think that there's an excellent chance that despite all of that, they will, because you've got, you know, serious ideologues on the court now that aren't as concerned about the legitimacy of the institution as Roberts always was. So this is the thing. It would not surprise me at all if they strike the whole thing down, which would make things easier for people like me who are urging the Democrats to, you know, at this point, I'm all for expansion. And one of the arguments against expanding the court that you hear most often is like, oh, well, Republicans will just expand it when they can. And I find a big problem with that argument is simply that it's very hard to capture a trifecta. You know, it's easier to hold the White House and the Senate and pack the courts that way than it is to hold the White House, the Senate, and the House and expand the courts. And then the other thing is our Supreme Court is way too small, and we could use more Supreme Court justices. You know, expand it to 13. Let them expand it to 15. It's fine.
Make it 113. I'm fine with that.
Yeah. You know, I mean, look, circuit courts have an average of 20 justices on them, and they are able to split into these panels. You always hear a three-judge panel of the whatever circuit court. They hear a lot more cases, and the bottom line is that the Supreme Court hears a tiny and declining fraction of the number of cases that are sent to it.
Yeah, and so all of this is a reaction. The Republicans very rarely do they think about consequences, right? I mean, they think about tomorrow and not next week. They are, even if they think about tomorrow, it's usually today. And so what they do not usually imagine is reactionary politics. Usually they are the source of reactionary politics. At least they have in the past 50 some years been the source of reactionary politics. But that's really been flipping since Trump took office. You know, that, like I was just telling a class, like the sea change among white Americans right now is pretty remarkable. And I do not see that going away if Trump were to win. And what in that is another statement, and that is, first of all, I'm really irritated for feeling dreadful. I really don't like feeling this way, and I'm starting to take it personally.
Yeah.
And so one thing we can look forward to for sure if Trump wins is more of what we've been doing so far among grassroots, progressives, liberals, etc. The number of white people right now who I think the Pew Center came out with a survey that says something like 60%, like a huge majority of white people saying to themselves, yeah, black people have it harder than I do, right? And yeah, the government should do something in order to alleviate some of the suffering among our fellow Americans. That is a huge change. And it was a change as a result of Donald Trump, right? During the Barack Obama era, a lot of white liberals in particular thought, just electing him had solved America's racial problems, right? And of course, that was wrong. And along comes Trump, and they realize, oh, you know what? We can't just vote. We have to do the work ourselves, right? We have to demonstrate. We have to raise hell in order to change America for the better. I actually think, you know, I'm a little, like I said, I'm a little pissed that I have to feel all this dread. In some way, I'm like, if there's one solace, one tiny bit of solace to a Trump victory, it would be a more radicalized group of what used to be the milquetoastiest voters you ever saw in white people in the suburbs. They're like really, really activated right now, and they will continue to be activated during a second Trump term. And that's a good thing.
I mean, you know, I think that a second Trump term would be so catastrophic that I can't really look at silver linings. But I must say that it is my hope, and we're looking at, you know, unprecedented mobilization by both sides.
Yeah.
It is my hope that, and there is research to suggest that voting is a habit.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know where this is all going. You know, we have multiple counties that have exceeded their entire 2016 vote.
Yeah.
With over a week left, with a week left to go.
Mm-hmm.
As of the end of yesterday, that is the end of Tuesday, with a week left to go before the election, the equivalent of 90% of the votes cast in Texas in 2016 had been cast in 2020.
Right. Wow. Yeah.
8.1 million votes, and in 2016, just under 9 million Texans voted. I don't know what any of this looks like. You know, if it is, and I should say, we don't know exactly how much of this is simply shifting from Election Day to earlier voting methods, you know, mail-in ballots and early voting because of the pandemic. But it certainly looks like, and again, you do have counties where they've already exceeded their 2016 vote count. It certainly looks like we're getting a, you know, completely unprecedented turnout. And I should point out that since 1908, the most turnout, the highest turnout rate was around 63%.
Mm-hmm.
Kennedy versus Nixon in 1960.
Yeah.
And so if we hit 70%, which could happen, you know, everything is uncharted waters in this election. Everything has been uncharted waters under Trump.
Mm-hmm.
That's uncharted waters. You know, we don't know what will happen at 70%. And I think also, you know, everybody's so traumatized by 2016. Nobody's really considering the possibility that the polling error could happen in the other direction.
Yeah, right. That's a good point. Yeah, you know, I'm going to be a contrarian for a minute about the whole voter turnout thing. Like, why is that happening now? You know, Trump is terrible, right? And people are responding to that. But, you know, why weren't people as passionate about voting in 2016 as they are today? You know, I just don't understand the idea of, you know, the idea that one person so bad or so good is going to inspire me to vote. And I think the problem is that we are more passionate as we don't think of ourselves as citizens as much as we think of ourselves in other ways that constitute an identity. We think of ourselves as, you know, Patriots fans more than we think of ourselves as citizens. And I think that's a problem that people are waking up to. It's just taken a huge human toll for people to wake up to that. And it's just, I find it tragic that has to be the way it is. I think if we had people who took responsibility for themselves as citizens and took the care that it takes to have a community of people that you want to see moving on to the future, you know, why vote in such numbers now versus in 2016? It should have always been this way, and it should always be this way.
I mean, for me, there's there are a couple of you know, theses that jump to mind. I mean, first of all, in 2016, you know, nobody expected Trump could win. You had two unpopular candidates. If you're asking more broadly why, you know, we generally have around 60% turnout and why that's not the case this year, I think it's because people respond to threats mm-hmm. in a way that they don't respond to persuasion.
Mm-hmm.
So people feel that Donald Trump is a visceral threat to them. And Trump supporters believe that Democrats are a visceral threat to them and their family.
Mm-hmm.
And that is much more potent than thinking, oh, I'm going to vote for this policy, or I'm going to vote because this candidate, you know, shares my values. It's this guy, you know, we've got 250,000 people dead. This guy's going around the country holding super spreader events. Mm-hmm. You know, we've lost 30 million jobs. It is a threat to me and my family for real. Like, it's a real threat. And this is something that I think is lost in a lot of the analysis of this country coming apart at the seams. And I intend to write about this at some point if I can ever find time to do it. There's been a lot of talk about, oh, you know, like experts say the United States is threatening to unravel. Our whole, you know, polity is against each other. Everybody's ready for a civil war, blah, blah, blah. And this is kind of portrayed as a problem on both sides, and it is a problem on both sides. But I think not enough attention is given to what each side fears about the other, mm-hmm. and the role of the conservative media in all of this, because mm-hmm. I can tell you that I am fearful of a group that wants to entrench minority rule by controlling the courts.
Mm-hmm.
I also have insurance through Obamacare, wants to take away my insurance, wants to take healthcare coverage from millions of people, low-income people who took advantage of the Medicaid expansion. These are people who make an intentional policy of separating children from their families at the border. There is Trump has shown a contempt for the rule of law. He has corrupted the Justice Department. I can give you a list of fact-based threats from another Trump term. And then if you went to a conservative who watches Fox News and you said, why are you afraid of Democrats? It's because they support Antifa looting. They want to, you know, impose socialism. They want to, you know, destroy jobs. They want to destroy Christianity. It's all bullshit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right.
And this seems like a very significant difference.
It's the biggest difference of them all. None of that really would make any difference if you didn't have respectable, legitimate reporters laundering the bullshit and making it appear either more legitimate or less threatening than it actually is. I mean, I had a piece today in the editorial board, you know, pointing out five of the big lies that reporters continue to either accept as true, or they just repeat them without being critical of them. You know, for instance, originalism. You know, the whole idea of originalism is, you know, pretty much bullshit on its face. You know, interpretation of the law does not mean, you know, what I want to see in the law. It's interpreting a law that isn't, in which the language is not clear, right? Its intention is not clear. And so you have to somehow figure out what the intention would be. The point of originalism is to see what they want to see in the law, but it's masked as some kind of high-minded principle. And that's what's the most infuriating thing about these big lies, is that they seem reasonable, they seem noble, but really they're not. They're none of those things. And in fact, they're intended to harm you if you're not on the right side. And there are lots of really smart people in the Washington press corps, and it just baffles me as to why they don't think about these things a little more critically. And some of them don't want to, I get that. But a lot of them do, but maybe, you know, they just, I don't, what I think for a lot of these press corps reporters is they don't understand that they're complicit in betrayal. I don't think they understand that they're actually a part of the problem in ways that they would do something about if they understood the situation properly.
Yeah, I mean, you know, working the refs works, and they've been hectored by the right so long that they feel like that's a way of displaying that they're fair and impartial. Mm-hmm. There was a moment on the 60 Minutes interview on Sunday where Kamala Harris was asked if she embraced a socialist agenda, and she just started laughing at the interviewer, which is, I think, a good response. But you know, this is a very large problem, and right now we're seeing something that is heartening, which is that you know, the media has not embraced this very, very sloppy Hunter Biden story at all in the way that they did in 2016. And I think part of that, central to that, is that the right screwed up the rollout really badly. So they, you know, in 2016, you had Clinton Cash author Peter Schweitzer got a piece in the New York Times. They gave the Times and CNN and the Washington Post advanced access to the text. Mm-hmm. They ran pieces that lent it legitimacy. And then, even though the basic story of Uranium One fell apart, they had already established that there was a real something there, something real that would be worthy of reporting in the New York Times and CNN. And then the rest is just, it's fuzzy. Once you've established that there's something shady, you could just throw out, you know, nonsense and it sticks. Right. And this time, because you had, you know, Rudy Giuliani with this crazy story about Hunter Biden dropping off laptops. Mm-hmm. Hunter lives in California. He dropped off the laptops to some guy in Delaware who just happens to be a Seth Rich truther. Mm-hmm. And that guy's story wasn't straight. He's blind, but he said, oh, I figured it must be Hunter Biden's laptop because I saw Bo Biden Foundation sticker on it. And then, like, it's just, you're like, what the fuck are you even talking about? And then nobody can figure out what actually the allegation is. There's a great piece in Politico today. Let me just read this. With bits and pieces of the entire Hunter Biden narrative floating across the conservative media sphere, few people on the right have been able to explain who exactly did what on behalf of whom. I'm telling you, that's totally true. Yeah. But that was the truth also with the Clinton Foundation story. Mm-hmm. But they rolled it out much better.
Yeah, and well, also they had a credulous press corps. I mean, they wanted to believe. You know, I think people make choices, and they're not as irrational as they think. There were people at the Times, in particular, who recognized an opportunity to pay attention to something that was going to get a lot of attention later on. They chose to believe the lies. This is what really bothers me about some Washington Press Corps members, is that they understand what's false, and what they understand the difference between true and false, what's probable, what's plausible. They understand all those nuances. That's how they got there. And so they're making choices about what to give legitimacy to. In the case of Hillary Clinton, it was the assumption that Trump could not win, that she would eventually be president, and it was establishing a beachhead of sorts to challenging the Hillary Clinton administration. And it was all based on an enormous misconception about what the Russians were capable of doing and what Fox News was willing to do in concert with the Russians, though perhaps accidentally in concert with the Russians, and what the Republican Party was willing to do with respect to its own loyalty to the United States of America. I don't think anybody could have imagined that that Mitch McConnell would turn a blind eye to actual espionage and sabotage on the part of the Russians. But there we are, right? And they can't. The other thing, so another part of the sea change, I think you're pointing out, is the kind of change among reporters. There's a sense, not a lot, but a few voices among in Washington journalism circles who are basically like, I don't really need to listen to this bullshit anymore. I can actually just ignore it if I want to.
Yeah.
And the whole Hunter Biden thing is an example of that. Like, you could ignore it and not pay a price. You know, you just, it's not going to hurt you in your career. In fact, you probably could get rewarded for just not appeasing the bullshit anymore. you know, just to stop. And that's all, and that's really all I want them to do.
Like, yeah,
that's the minimum.
Yeah, and maybe they'll learn something from it, because, you know, the thing that they need to understand is that these people, their critics on the right, are not acting in good faith and will squeal and scream bias no matter what they do, no matter how far they bend over backwards to placate them. They are implacable. Mm-hmm. And that's something that they really need to learn. John Storr, I want to thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us. I believe we are out of time.
Thanks so much.
I'd also like to thank Liz Preza and David Edwards, our producer and engineer. I'd like to thank the folks at Raw Story and Alternet for supporting the show. You can follow me on Twitter at Joshua Hall, H-O-L. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. I'd like to thank you good people for tuning in. You know, wait in those lines if you're voting early in person. And stay safe. Have a good week.
Yeah. Like a light emerging out of the darkness. Like a phoenix rising out of the ashes. Triumphant. And I'll never fall again. No, I'll never fall again.
Trapped in the dirt, feeling like my core done collapsed on my earth. Not worry about the brand that's attached to my shirt. Trying not to fall off, go back, no reverse. Cursed, but I'm blessed. Through the cracks I emerge from the depths where it's all death. Who will fall next? Stress upon stress, make palms sweat. Trying to dodge threats. Threats don't leave, see, that's the concept. But I've come a long trek. Came a long way from the front porch steps. I'm on a conquest, won't see none lesser. Pristine wood dresser, suburban dream pressure. Though I seem hood reckless, the bags under eyes, equivalent to size of the bags when I fly. I fell down once, but I won't fall again. But in case, get it safe to break the fall when I land. Listen.
Like a light emerging out of the darkness. Like a phoenix rising out of the ashes. Triumphant, and I'll never.
My failures, my courage, let it build up. Never down for long, walk to the ground, it's gone. Door open, never sealed up. I filled up on despair, but I spit it up though. Early morning, what you think I'm getting up for? I disregard the naysayers banging at my front door. Blood in my eyes, but I wipe it out. Got me surfing on the cloud, I don't plan on wiping out. Getting pretty dark, had to throw some light around. I don't care what I'm around, I rise up from out the ground. Not a dead body, my head got me confused. I feel I'm down, but my heart won't allow me to lose. So this is all or nothing. I go hard, is it all for nothing? Or is it worth more? The outcome that I work for got me clutching to the side of the wall. I won't fall on my way to be triumphant.
Like a light emerging out of the darkness. Like a phoenix rising out.